Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you here at Silicon Valley Bank. My name is Mark Gorenberg. It's my honor to introduce Dr. Susan Hockfield, the president of MIT. Dr. Hockfield spent nearly 20 years at Yale University serving as director of graduate studies in neurobiology, dean of graduate school of arts and sciences, and provost. President Hockfield was first introduced to the MIT community on August 26, 2004, by a letter from the MIT Corporation Search Committee that said that she, quote, emerged as the best person to lead MIT to new frontiers of innovation and leadership in research and education. She possesses a rare combination of scientific achievement, outstanding managerial talent, and an extremely engaging personal style that will serve MIT's faculty, students, and staff very well, end quote. I don't think the committee could have imagined how good a job they did in their selection and really how clairvoyant those first words would be 7 years later. As MIT president, Dr. Hockfield has launched many world-leading initiatives, including an institute-wide initiative on energy research, and has expanded the collaborative intersections of life sciences and engineering, particularly in cancer research. President Hockfield has established new worldwide partnerships for MIT, has brought MIT to new levels of involvement in Washington, D.C., where, for example, President Obama called upon her to join him at the White House to call for a new era of clean energy, and just recently named her and Dow Chemical CEO Andrew Lavaris to co-chair an industry-university task force called Advanced Manufacturing Partnership. She's also a director of the General Electric Company, a trustee of the Carnegie Corporation of New York, and a member of the Board of Overseers of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. At MIT, we've seen President Hockfield's contagious enthusiasm at work. And let me describe her the same way that she describes MIT, which is that she has incredible energy. She's strikingly practical. She embraces and learns from differences. She fosters collaboration. She raises the bar. And she measures success by how many people she brings along. And we truly expect she'll be bringing along all of you here tonight. So please join me in welcoming President Susan Hockfield.
Well, that was an enormously sweet and generous introduction, Mark. I really appreciate it. It's been quite an adventure being at MIT these last 7 years, and I don't know that any of us knew what we were getting into, not the search committee nor I. It's great to come out here to Northern California. I love being here. Happy to see so many MIT alumni with us tonight. Whenever I come out here, it feels like home because we've got permanent ambassadors here for MIT, so it's great to be here. I welcome members of the Commonwealth Club. I'm delighted to be here. It's really a privilege to be at this podium with all of you this evening. I want to leave plenty of time for your questions, but I'm going to start the evening off by talking a little bit about America's innovation economy, how it emerged, how it's working, and some steps that I believe we can do to strengthen it. Now, I step into a discussion of the innovation economy acknowledging several things. First of all, the obvious, I'm not an entrepreneur. I'm not an economist. I don't have any high-tech innovations up my sleeve, although I know many of you do. I'm talking to you before this part of the evening. And bringing innovation ideas to Silicon Valley feels to me like a 21st century version of bringing coals to Newcastle. So, all that said, I feel I do have some standing in the field because I have the privilege of leading one of the nation's premier research universities focused on science and engineering. And in that position, it gives me an unusual perspective on what makes our innovation economy work. So today, the country is understandably preoccupied with one central question, and that's where will our much-needed jobs come from? Bringing on new jobs is the key to getting the economy back on track. And at such a moment, there is no more important subject than how we can retool the innovation engine. That's the engine that's driven wave after wave of U.S. economic and jobs growth since the end of World War II. And that, along the way, helped produce Silicon Valley, one of the industrial wonders of the world. So first of all, what do I mean when I talk about innovation, when I say innovation? And our innovation system comes to life from the spark of scientific discovery and invention. But the kind of innovation that drives real economic growth goes beyond a cool idea or some simply incremental improvement on an old practice or product. So when I talk about innovation, I mean the kind of innovations that produce really big new ideas based in science or technology that can be transformed into marketable products. Innovations that can create new markets, sometimes even new industries, and that create a future that's different from and better than the present. So you might be surprised by how many of those innovations, the kinds that I'm talking about, were seeded by federal research funding. And I just have a short list among many I could talk about. Real-time network computing that incorporated radical advances to transform computers from what were essentially overgrown calculators used by a handful of scientists into the communications infrastructure of our entire society today. Or PET scans that allow doctors to pinpoint malignant tumors without any kind of invasive procedure. Or lasers that not so very long ago, to some of us in the room, seems like only yesterday, these were simply arcane scientific tools. No one had any idea what they might be able to do. And they now lend their power to mere mortals as we scan barcodes at the checkout counter, burn CDs, or have our vision corrected. Or GPS, a technology that was invented for positioning nuclear missiles and now offers a universal way for us to find our way to a hospital, a job interview, or, as I use it in a new city, the nearest Starbucks. Or e-books. I'm on a trip now. I'm carrying more books with me than I will ever have an opportunity to read, probably in my lifetime, but I do it electronically. Or Siri, that eerily effective voice-activated personal assistant in the new iPhone 4S. Perhaps many of you have it sitting in your pocket right now. And Siri evolved from a DARPA project to improve decision-making on the battlefield. Now, today, all of these life-changing, market-rocking innovations have become routine tools, and they all have something in common. They grew out of advanced research at American research universities. They were supported by federal research dollars, and they were translated into market-ready ideas by American entrepreneurs and companies that have had a dramatic impact on our economy. Now, that's America's innovation system at work, and it didn't happen by accident. In fact, it's a direct descendant of the investment-based research and development system that the U.S. invented to develop the technologies like radar and the atomic bomb that won World War II. When you think about it, there were three sets of investments that drove the economic growth in the United States following World War II. The first, Presidents Truman and Eisenhower, working with Congress and guided by truly visionary scientific advisors, recognized that the same strategy of investing in advanced scientific research that had produced incredible war-winning results could produce technologies that could win in peacetime, too. Other nations have funded research, were funding research since World War II, but at a much lower level, and mainly at freestanding research institutes. By contrast, the U.S. focused its research investments on peer-reviewed, university-based research. From California and Texas to Michigan and Massachusetts, universities competed for federal funds on the scientific merits. And those federal investments reinvented American universities as powerhouses of modern scientific and technological research. The second investment has been in education. And that investment built profoundly on the first. In response to Cold War fears about Soviet scientific dominance, many of us will remember how that fear was escalated to an incredible degree by Sputnik. The National Defense Education Act of 1958 drove aggressive investments in science and math education, directing close to $1 billion to student loans, fellowships, K-12 science and math instruction, and something that we used to call VOTEC, or vocational and technical training. The third investment amplified the power of the first two. With the passage of the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, the relative openness of our culture to immigrant talent, to brilliant strivers from around the world, turned our universities into even more powerful magnets for the world's most ambitious scientists, engineers, inventors, and entrepreneurs. These three investments together produced ideas that flowed out of academic labs and into the marketplace and helped deliver huge gains in productivity and employment by fueling one innovation wave after another. Electronics and semiconductors in the 1960s and 70s, mainframe and mini computers in the 70s and 80s, personal computing and the internet in the 90s, and biotech in the 1990s. In fact, economists have shown that in the period since World War II, more than half of U.S. economic growth can be attributed to technological innovation, much of it springing from federally funded advanced scientific research. Silicon Valley, of course, stands as a testament to the cumulative effect of the IT wave that crested in the 1990s, surely one of the most successful periods in U.S. economic history. From 1995 to 2000, the U.S. sustained annual GDP growth of 4.2% and productivity growth of 3.5%. These are absolutely stunning increases for a mature economy. And everyone across the nation saw real economic income growth, not just those at the very top. The IT wave also had a transformative impact on jobs. In the decade of the 1990s, the U.S. economy created 22 million net new jobs, 2.2 million new jobs a year. Now, comparing that to our current status of lackluster job growth only underscores the importance of the innovation agenda today. What's more, it's not going to surprise anyone in this audience that technology-based companies have a disproportionately positive effect on their local economies. When they sell products into national and global markets, they draw money into the local economy from outside, quite unlike new service-based companies like a new dry cleaner or a new restaurant. The external market that these companies access give technology-based firms the capital to scale up, which is another powerful engine of job creation. There is a particularly important last link in this chain I've been describing for you. During many research-based revolutions, I would say most until the most recent one, we not only made the ideas here, we actually made the products here too. And I'll give you just one example, semiconductors, the core technology behind the IT wave, and we made them here. When Japanese competitors moved ahead, the U.S. sector took on the challenge. By inventing new manufacturing processes for equipment suppliers, the public-private partnership known as Semitech, we recaptured the technological lead. This inspired consortium explains why U.S. semiconductor firms still lead in world markets. So the big question for all of us is, if our innovation system has such enormous power, where is it now when we really need it? How can we crank it up to produce more new job-generating, economy-building companies? Well, I'm happy to report that our innovation system is alive and mostly well, but at the same time, I really do believe we can make it more effective by reexamining it and recommitting ourselves to some of the elements that made it so powerful in the previous periods of economic growth. There are lots of lessons to be learned from the last half century of innovation waves, but I would just suggest to you four rules or principles that can help us focus on a plan of action. Rule one is that growing new ideas takes money, no surprise, from the right source at the right time. There is surely a right time for venture capital money to back a new idea, and California happens to be the number one magnet for VC money in the country. But VC money is hardly an unwavering resource. A new report reveals that from 2007 to 2010, investment by U.S. venture capitalists in the United States dropped by 26%. That's not a direction that bodes for future success. And well before VC dollars get into the game, if we want big breakthrough innovations to drive our economy, there is no substitute, absolutely no substitute, for sustained, strong federal funding for advanced early-stage research. Sustained federal funding through the second half of the 20th century generated the breakthroughs that unleashed the IT and biotech innovation waves. Today, there are new technology sectors that are ready to launch. Clean energy, robotics, advanced materials, the convergence of the life and engineering sciences in biomedicine and beyond. These are poised to drive new innovation waves and the jobs that go with them. But the ownership of these next waves hang in the balance. Are we going to let other nations lead them, or will we seize the potential for American economic growth and American jobs? Frankly, if we let Congress slash funding for advanced research, we will lose our advantage in the next job-creating waves of innovation. Now, the Congressional Super Committee is approaching its Thanksgiving deadline, and I don't know about you, but I see that the threat of sequestration, it seems perilously real at this moment. At this moment, the public needs to understand that the anticipated impact on research funding would be devastating. Through sequestration, a 10% cut would be inflicted, a cut that gets locked in, that would produce stagnation for a decade. Institutions here like UC Berkeley, Stanford, UCSF, institutions like MIT, gave the United States its innovation edge but undercutting national investments in fundamental research would mean kissing future prosperity goodbye. Rule two, if you want your innovation system to thrive, you want to attract brilliant strivers and help them get all the education and hands-on experience they can handle. We really need to capitalize on this country's ability to attract talent from all over the world. It has been the secret of America's success for centuries. You all know the statistic well. More than half of Silicon Valley startups are launched by people who were born outside the United States. At MIT, 40% of our current faculty were not born in the United States. Nationally, in electrical and electronics engineering, 55% of master's graduates and 63% of new PhDs are foreign nationals. Yet amazingly, if when these students enter the country, they had told an immigration officer that what they really wanted to do was get a degree and stay in the country, they would have been turned back at the border. Our immigration laws specifically require that students return to their home countries after earning their degrees and then apply for a visa if they want to return and work in the United States. Why in the world would we want to deflect these brilliant young people from staying in the United States after we've worked so hard to educate them? It would be hard to invent a policy that would be more counterproductive to our national interests. You know, not so long ago, and I say not so long ago as being 10 or 15 years ago, if you wanted to pursue advanced science and engineering, the United States was essentially your only choice. It was everyone's first choice, and second choice was a distant second. And foreign graduates of, you know, MIT, Berkeley, Stanford, and other great universities would put up with, I call it the indignities of the American immigration system in order to stay here. But between 2000 and 2007, the percentage actually declined of graduate students from China, India, Korea, Japan, and Canada. These are the nations that send us the greatest number of students. The percentage declined of students who had definite plans to stay in the United States following graduation. Now, those statistics I can follow only up until 2007, and I hesitate, actually, I fear what the effect of the recession has been on that particular statistic. Our ability to capture world talent has been a remarkable U.S. competitive advantage for two centuries, and it would be absolutely tragic to lose it. In a world that is now teeming with well-funded venues for doing first-class research, the cumbersome rigidity of our immigration system has become a great liability. To be competitive, the United States needs to send an absolutely unambiguous signal that we want international scholars to stay. We should insist that Congress revamp our arcane immigration laws to encourage newly educated talent from around the world to remain in the United States. This is often called stapling a green card to a diploma. We also obviously need to encourage our homegrown strivers as well. We've got to dramatically improve science, math, engineering education, and increase the number of United States graduates in these fields. You know, MIT is a bit anomalous. Actually, it's extremely anomalous. 85% of our bachelor's degrees are awarded in the natural sciences or engineering, 85%. Nationally, that number is 15%. And what I only kind of add a little parenthesis here, at MIT, it's 85% of the women and 85% of the men get bachelor's degrees in the natural sciences and engineering. So kind of, you know, calling the mythology that women don't do science or engineering. The United States now trails more than 16 nations in Europe and Asia in the proportion of 24-year-olds with bachelor's degrees in these important fields. And what's more, from 1989 to 2003, the number of American science and engineering PhDs remained absolutely constant at about 26,600 a year. And over that same period and in the same fields, the PhDs awarded in China shot up from 1,000 to 12,000. And it continues to rise. The trend speaks for itself. Rule three, scientists and engineers can make great entrepreneurs, but an entrepreneurial culture helps them flourish. Without entrepreneurs, the drive and persistence to carry new ideas all the way into the market, without that, an innovation becomes simply a gizmo that gathers dust in a lab. You've got to push great ideas all the way into the marketplace. Entrepreneurship is vitally important to the jobs question also. Economists at the Kauffman Foundation have determined that companies that produce the most jobs are the new ones, and they report that since 1980, nearly all net job creation has come from companies in the United States that are less than 5 years old. Now, many people will argue that entrepreneurs are born and not made, but our experiences at MIT likely match the experiences here in Silicon Valley, that an entrepreneurial culture, one that encourages new ideas, a culture that permits mistakes, and one that makes it easy to connect to talent and money can make a tremendous difference. Every research university, public and private, can do more to build up its entrepreneurial culture. And let me just suggest a few ideas that have great power. The first is to encourage faculty and students to launch startups and build curricula and mentor networks to teach them how. The second is, of course, you've got to license technology seamlessly and fast to get products in the marketplace. Third, we love our startup competitions. The students love them, brings a lot of people into the mix. In these startup competitions, students have a chance to test drive and showcase their entrepreneurial teams. And the last one is to organize alumni entrepreneurs to advise the fledgling ones. They do it for free, and then they thank you for having given them the opportunity. This last idea sounds really crazy to people who haven't experienced it, but I can tell you, it works magically. We've got a couple of organizations that are structured for mentors to help. Our venture mentoring service is started and run by alumni volunteers. They started with less than $3 million in funding over 10 years, and it has helped launch 142 ventures that have raised $850 million in external financing. It has also helped start venture mentoring services at a number of other places. Another breakthrough program is the Deshpande Center for Technological Innovation. Our faculty may be brilliant, but many of them have absolutely no experience in writing business plans or starting companies. So the Deshpande Center gives them a little bit of startup funds and then partners them with mentors who have the guidance to help them launch their own firms. And in the last 9 years, the Deshpande Center used about $11 million to fund about 90 projects and has seen the creation of 26 companies, which have raised more than $350 million in outside financing. Finally, my last rule, rule four. If we want to make U.S. jobs, we can't just make ideas here. We have to make the products here. Many people I talk to about manufacturing are convinced that nothing is made in America anymore. But the truth is the United States remains the second largest manufacturer on Earth, and manufacturing is still vital to our economy. In 2007, manufacturing contributed $1.6 trillion, or 13.4% of our GDP. Manufacturing provides 12 million direct jobs, direct production jobs, and there's something on the order of another 30 million U.S. jobs that depend on manufacturing. Manufacturing jobs are not just good in themselves. The health of the sector figures prominently in our innovation capacity. U.S. manufacturing firms employ 64% of America's scientists and engineers, and they conduct about 70% of U.S. R&D. Now, unfortunately, the challenges for U.S. manufacturing are truly profound and frustratingly difficult. One example, 10 years ago, we had a trade surplus in advanced technology manufactured goods. Today, that category alone accounts for an $81 billion annual trade deficit. And what that means is that we're buying back technologies that we invented. And there are many who believe that by outsourcing manufacturing to lower-wage countries, U.S. firms may have unwittingly begun to outsource our innovative capacity as well by interrupting the two-way flow of information between the factory floor and the drawing board. So the fact is that no matter how brilliant our new innovations, they don't translate into the kind of durable growth and jobs we need unless some substantial fraction are actually made in America. You know, we all recognize that workers for this new era of advanced manufacturing are predominantly going to come from high schools and community colleges, and there are some excellent models for preparing workers for 21st century manufacturing. Many of them are here in California. 2 years ago, I visited a great program at Oakland Tech, which is a hands-on engineering program, and hands-on engineering and design are at the core of the New Technology High School in Napa and also form the core of the High Tech High schools in San Diego. So let me just close with a reflection on something that, frankly, is a lot harder than anything we've already talked about, and it has to do with our nation's cultural assumptions, and I want to make a call to change them. I was a panelist in a recent panel on innovation, and the moderator asked me why any entrepreneur would bother to go to college, because, of course, there are some very successful college dropouts. So with all due respect to Peter Thiel, let me be very clear. The kind of innovations that drive lasting economic growth emerge from the most advanced science, mathematics, and technology. The advanced batteries that we think will power our new electric cars, a lower carbon energy world, the chemistry in those batteries is not chemistry that's taught in high school. Similarly, the biological engineering that allowed Genentech to develop the first generation of biologically targeted breast cancer drugs, you know, that's just not stuff that's taught in high school either. We need our brightest young women and men all across the country to value advanced education and invention as much as they love football and basketball. We need them to understand that the smartphones and the video games and the music players that they covet were invented by people just like them, and that science and engineering offers them the power to become not merely the world's consumers and spectators, but its makers and doers, the inventors and creators who will restore American prosperity. If we hope to revive America's economic prospects, there is plenty of hard work ahead to get our innovation system humming again. I mentioned leading the charge for sustained federal funded research, reforming immigration, building entrepreneurial ecosystems, and seizing the opportunities of advanced manufacturing. And I hope that all of you feel as inspired as I do to fight these important battles. But I would urge all of you to tackle this harder problem too, and tackle it by doing something simpler, you know, whatever your profession. Let us please find ways to celebrate America's inventors and entrepreneurs. By making them our children's heroes today, we'll enable our children to be the heroes who are going to turn on the lights in America's factories tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hockfield. My name is Steve Wright, and I'm the Communications Vice President at the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. We have 345 member companies here in Silicon Valley. And I'm also a member of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley Advisory Council, and I'm going to help moderate our Q&A. Thank you to many of you who've already filled out some questions. If you have some that you haven't written out, please do so, and a member of the staff will pick them up. Dr. Hockfield, you really speak the language of Silicon Valley, I would say, based on those remarks. Federal funding, STEM education, immigration changes are all things that are important here in the Valley. One of the members of the audience had a similar question to mine, so I'm going to let that one trump and start out with it first. And that is, it was great to hear you talk about how important federal funding is for innovation and for emerging technologies. Of course, Silicon Valley has a glaring example of a very bad investment. Less than 5 miles from here, the shuttered Solyndra manufacturing plant and Solyndra's key offices are closed up and the parking lot is empty. What should members of Congress be really thinking about in regard to this investment? And what, if anything, should change for future investment?
Yeah, so this is an area in which I'm not an expert, and the area that I'm talking about, I'm not an expert, and I'm not an expert in the politics of investment choices. And I would simply start out by making the observation that, you know, there are probably a number of mid-sized solar companies that have failed, and it's easy after the fact, of course, the Monday morning quarterback to talk about what play spelled doom for the team. So I can't really judge. I think as a nation, we have a very serious problem, and I don't have an easy solution for it. And it's the extraordinary subsidies that other countries are willing to put into their growing industries. Industrial policies, which, of course, is something that the United States is allergic to. But in China, the balance is one would say, you know, not quite, doesn't provide the level playing field that we believe, should inhabit the marketplace. And so, you know, labor in China is cheaper. It's getting more expensive. The Chinese government makes commodities cheap. They make energy cheap. And when you're in an energy-intensive business like building solar cells, you know, that makes a big difference. And, huge subsidies for the solar industry in China. I think it's something like, you know, the top six solar companies have received about $50 billion in, you know, low-cost loans. So I don't think we should abandon this area. And as I said, I'm not going to, you know, I have no way to comment on whether, you know, the Solyndra bet was a good bet or a bad bet. And, you know, there'll be various politics around it. But I have to tell you, my hope is in some of the up-and-coming solar technologies that, on my faculty, the people who are working on it, say we're in a very good position to develop a solar industry in the United States that could compete ferociously with the Chinese. So I'm optimistic about technology development. And, we have to – I still believe that the marketplace has to help us decide what wins and what doesn't win. We can't pick winners in advance.
Right. And I assume, though, that you still believe very strongly, though, that the federal government should not see this particular investment as something that should change the whole rules for federal investment the way some have been talking.
Yeah, that would be a disaster. Yeah. And the idea, you know, for the MIT Energy Initiative, kind of the operating premise for it is we don't know what technology is going to win. Right. And anyone who tells you that they do is either hallucinating or lying.
Great. Thank you very much. Here's an audience question. What other nations or societies are there that you see as role models in terms of innovation? And What is it that we could learn from some of these other countries?
You know, it's a great question. Certainly not a week goes by, and some weeks not a day goes by, when there isn't someone in my office from someplace in the world saying, please, could MIT come teach us how to do innovation? And I don't think, you know, the United States didn't invent innovation. There were plenty of innovative societies and innovative countries, you know, before the United States got in the game. But we certainly, in the second half of the 20th century, you know, figured out how to, you know, fire that up at a level that we haven't, you know, seen before. We work a lot with Singapore, and Singapore has a very aggressive, very thoughtful set of investments that have been productive. I think they haven't quite got the innovation piece going, but they're working very hard to build it. But the fact is they're pouring money into the education and also the business side of developing an innovation economy. We're working in Abu Dhabi, in Masdar City. And that's another interesting way of going about it, where you say, you know, this is a city where we're going to do everything about the energy future. So really investing and bringing people into a very attractive, resource-rich enterprise. I think, you know, as you look around, there's great innovation going on in old Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, perhaps not at the kind of you know, velocity that we see in the United States. And, you know, I think there are interesting things to learn. But I think one of the things that we see is countries around the world copying what the United States did after World War II. Mm-hmm. And I think competition is a great thing. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's fabulous that countries around the world are racing to reproduce the American innovation system. We're going to have to leap ahead to the next chapter of our own innovation system if we want to continue to maintain this kind of, you know, position one
right.
that we've had for so many decades.
Well, you know, you mentioned, I think, a little bit about industrial policy. Many of these countries do have an industrial policy. There are many CEOs here who get visits all the time from other countries, from Malaysia to China. Mm-hmm. And those countries will not only give free or low-interest money, but they will also give the land for the factory and, in many instances, create the market so that you can scale up quickly. You know, by either requiring some part of it to – some part of the product to be part of the overall economy. What do you think – do you think we need an industrial policy? And if so, what would be the top three things that you would – want to see included? Yeah.
So I think that, you know, industrial policy, I'm still skeptical of it myself, but I grew up here. And, but I think there are some tweaks we need to do. So making the R&D tax credit permanent seems to me like such a no-brainer. I mean, why have we not done that if it's a country that where we understand that R&D is at the foundation of everything we do? I think, you know, my own view is I'm really interested in the growing industries that are long-cycle industries. And, you know, we should probably be thinking about doing something to encourage people to invest in the long term. Mm-hmm. I'm a little nervous about how fast you can make money in software, because if you can make money that fast in software, who's going to invest in, you know, the new biotechnologies? Who's going to mm-hmm. invest in the new energy technologies that have a cycle time of, a decade or two? Mm-hmm. So I think there are tweaks. And, you know, Tom Friedman has talked about it, and when I first heard him describe it, we had a conversation a couple of years ago, and he said, we have a de facto industrial policy in the United States, and it's just the things I talked about. You know, mm-hmm. we invest in research. We're early in universal K-12 education. We believe in college accessibility for all. We have a rule of law, you know, and the law around intellectual property protection. We have, strong infrastructure. So the things that we have done that have substituted for industrial policy and that has worked well for us. You know, the competition is using another set of rules. And I personally believe that by doing the kind of wide open wild marketplace that the United States has done so well, you know, we're likely to succeed in, you know, the long term at levels that we couldn't possibly by engineering an industrial policy.
Hmm. Okay, something to think about. Thank you. That's good. A question from the audience goes to one of your points about immigration and education. Do you have much hope that Congress will see the light as Australia has and open all immigration to all college grads, including bachelor's, master's, and PhDs?
I spend a fair amount of the time I spend in Washington, and I'm in Washington, you know, every month or two, talking about immigration policy. And while there is some legislation which is coming forward around immigration for people with advanced degrees in STEM fields, the people who are wise about the ways of Washington, bless their hearts, are not optimistic about it. And I wish we could be optimistic about it because it seems to me, again, you know, essentially a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. And they're not optimistic because there are many who believe we need the full comprehensive immigration policy, mm-hmm. and they don't want to release the no-brainer piece of it without getting the rest of the immigration policy fixed. But maybe we'll be surprised.
Well, we shouldn't hold our breath, I don't think.
But. I don't think we should. I was going to make a terrible political. I'm going to say it.
All right, I'll stop you there. Yeah. Another audience question goes back to your comment about R&D tax credits. How do you think one of the big stumbling blocks is Congress always says, how do we pay for it? Do you have any ideas along that line?
How do we pay for it?
The R&D tax credit, what it would take out of the budget.
I don't know what the dollar amount is, but it's we're in this very funny discussion now that looking at a time frame that is about, I don't know, is it 3 months or maybe it's as much as 4 months, that you know you either spend or you save. And so we've lost a sense of growth economics where you invest and grow the economy and the return is – you know, much greater than what you invest in the beginning. So this kind of, you know, I wouldn't even call it calculus. It's just the arithmetic of the moment is a very dangerous way to think about the nation's economy.
Uh-huh. Good. And then you've talked about investments in education. And, you know, here in Silicon Valley, there are a lot of CEOs and other leaders who really work hard on trying to promote STEM education, especially for girls. Mm-hmm. But there was a recent New York Times article that stated that a high number of people who enter college and mark their science or engineering as their as what they hope to graduate with a degree in actually change it to something else before they graduate.
40%.
40%.
And 60% if you include pre-med.
Right. So that's astounding. So how do we get young people on track and then once they get into college to stay on track so that we can grow more of our own scientists and engineers?
Okay, so I've got kind of...
I figured you were ready for this one.
I'm ready for this one, and I have two different directions. So the first is, well, sure, we can make science, math, engineering, education better, more fun, more engaging. And, you know, a lot of us are doing this. So it's, you know, people love doing hands-on stuff. You know, every five-year-old's an inventor. Mm-hmm. How do we drive it out of, you know, drive it out by the time they're all 15? So I think, you know, obviously, you know, education can be more interesting and can be compelling. That's one thing I'd say. But on the other hand, I want to get back to this culture problem. Because in the article, it also talked about, oh, science, math, and engineering, they're just so hard. And, you know, I watch kids around America play soccer for 6 hours a day after school, or the kids who row crew, I mean, row till they are literally sick. I mean, kids in America work hard at some things. But somehow it's not okay to work hard. There's no glory in working hard to get science and math and engineering down. And so it is a cultural problem that we have where you're considered to be some kind of nitwit if you work hard on math. And so we have, you know, what I often call an ambition deficit in the country. Mm-hmm. And the countries that outscore us by, you know, leaps and bounds in math and science achievement in high school, you know, those aren't countries where they're doing fancy-dancy educational things and, you know, right. building. They're just working hard because they're countries that actually value high achievement mm-hmm. in the kinds of fields that drive economic growth.
You know, at one point here, we talked about in Silicon Valley about having Letterman's jackets for people who were math or science achievers instead of it always being for sports. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah. So I've resisted saying too much about MIT, but one of the things that is fascinating is the undergraduates who come to MIT, and it's not for everybody. No question, it's not for everyone. Since 85%, you know, you're around, you know, almost
a lot of engineers.
A lot of engineers, a lot of scientists.
Yeah.
But what many students experience in coming to MIT is an experience of just elation, because these are young people who just personally got a lot out of studying. They just liked studying math and science.
It's their people.
It's their people, and they come in. It's people, and wow, everyone's doing this, and it's just lots of fun. And it's one. I mean, you don't wish the whole world was like MIT, because it is not. You know, it's different, but you sure wish there were more places where that kind of exhilaration in pitting yourself against the great intellectual problems of, you know, the world was more celebrated.
Well, since we have a room full of MIT graduates, what do you folks think about what she's just said? Did you enjoy that? Maybe a round of applause if you did. That's right. Great. These same graduates like political questions, and you may want to shy away from some of them, but I'm going to dutifully ask them. One is Washington too dysfunctional to create effective policies? And if you had a magic wand, what would you do to them?
the last part
was mine. But
yeah, I'd make them get the job done. I don't have any unique insight into what's going on in Washington, but it is quite troublesome that as a nation we seem to have lost the ability to come together around very difficult issues in very difficult times. Mm-hmm. I think what happened this summer was I don't think it was a great embarrassment for the nation. I'm concerned about it, not just because of the dysfunctionality or apparent dysfunctionality of our government. I had some we're hosting some Taiwanese business people at MIT. This is now probably a year and a half ago. And a CEO of a great company came up to me and said, you know, this United States model doesn't really work, does it? and offered other countries that had a better model for governing themselves and a better model for economic growth. And that was stunning to me. And so, you know, maybe our government, you know, it doesn't always work well. We have periods where we have been less effective in the past and have become more effective. But I have to tell you, at a time when there are countries around the world that are emerging into, you know, new forms of government or emerging into growing economies, for the United States not to be a model is a huge loss. And so I worry about it for the sake of our country, but I also worry about it in terms of what the world 25 years from now will look like if the United States has not served as a good model for other governments.
That's a good point. One of my favorite sayings is that democracy is painful. And that's what we end up with
and
sometimes.
Messy.
Yeah, and very messy. So let me ask just a follow-up question to that, though. And my organization takes 60 to 80 CEOs to Washington a couple times a year. In my observation, I'd be interested in your observation about whether you think people, our representatives in Congress, really get innovation, if they get science, do they get technology? My view is not so much. But you're there. You're on the inside. What can we do about it?
Yeah. So I think we have to. I mean, so the reflex when you see what's going on in Washington is to kind of turn your eyes away and certainly don't think about going there. You know, we have to engage, and you know, they are our elected representatives, and you know, it is a form of government. If we don't like them, we've got to throw them out and or actually help them understand what we're doing. And I've had some very encouraging experiences with a number of people in Congress who they really didn't understand the argument, and to patiently go through the argument with them. Not just one person carrying that message, but many people carrying the message, they can change their mind. And do they get innovation? I would say, by and large, I've been impressed by the intelligence, of the people who are there. But the political forces, I think, often trump, the simply a good rational argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe, frankly, that the nation as a whole gets innovation. Mm-hmm. I don't believe the nation as a whole understands this pipeline that I described. I mean, I don't think the nation as a whole understands really what has made Silicon Valley this extraordinary, engine of innovation and economic growth that it has been. And, people have very simple views of it. But it's, I think, seen in our lackadaisical approach to K-12 education.
Right. Thank you. Another audience question, this time on research, and especially research in universities. This particular question asks, research often creates silos within universities. How does MIT inspire and blend some of the different research so to get away from the silo and really get the most you can out of the research?
Yeah. I mean, silos are described as pernicious, but there's a reason why they grew up, and it's because you share a vocabulary. You share technologies and you work together, and so you kind of become a group isolated from the rest. Happily, MIT, from the very beginning, was designed as a place that is more permissive of cross silo work, horizontal connections, and we do a lot to foster that. Kind of one of the huge multidisciplinary research projects at MIT was the Rad Lab during World War II, where radar was developed. Mm-hmm. The radar insights, the real innovation came from Britain, but they lacked the wherewithal to actually develop them into real products during World War II. And so they brought the technology to MIT. And it was a group of about 4,000 people, I think, at its largest, but there were physicists and mathematicians, there were linguists.
Mm-hmm.
I learned recently Paul Samuelson, the economist, was there in the Rad Lab. I mean, this crazy mix of people and producing amazing new science, but also turning that science into real technologies, real applications that could do things like see submarines and planes flying at night. And coming out of that, MIT developed the practice of having cross-disciplinary labs and centers. And so the way we think about it is the departments and schools are columns, and then the rows are cross-disciplinary labs where the faculty from a number of different disciplines will be together working on projects. The energy initiative that we launched 5 years ago is along the same line that, a lot of people think the energy solution is just going to be some great new technology, but great technology by itself goes nowhere. You've got to have great policy also.
Mm-hmm.
And so the energy initiative is about new technology, it's about policy, it's about education, and it calls on people from all five of the schools. But it sets up a construct where people can work together from the Department of Political Science and the Department of Mechanical Engineering. And so we overtly and with intent, create venues where people can work across disciplines. It helps if you have the view that you're supposed to solve problems in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has been, MIT was founded to accelerate the industrialization of America. And so our focus has been, even while we do abstract theory and very fundamental science, there's always this drive to or toward real-world applications. And I think that really helps break down silos. If you have to have something really work in the real world, you don't really care who has the bits and pieces of the answer.
Well, then a follow-up question to that would be, there's a lot of excitement, I think, about the convergence of the intersection of some of the research going on with life sciences and physical and engineering sciences. Can you give us a better idea of what that means? but then also, what kind of innovation you can expect we might be out there in the future for us?
Yeah, so this is, I believe after arriving at MIT and seeing what people are doing, I think this is going to be the story of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I think about it is that the story of the 20th century was the convergence between the physical sciences and engineering. So that thing that started happening with the nuts and bolts of the physical universe becoming understood at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, engineers are great. You know, they'll take anything, you know, and use it as a tool to solve some problem. And so that convergence between engineering and the physical science gave rise to electronics and, you know, the computer industry and the, you know, information industries. And now biology has gotten to the stage where, you know, there's a parts list for biology, and the engineers are, and physical science is just picking that up also. So what that means is not just that biology has become more of a quantitative science than it was, but it also means that, you know, a third of the faculty in the School of Engineering at MIT are now using the tools of the life sciences in their work. And we talk about it, the first thing you think about is medical devices, right, or imaging devices. And this convergence will have a big impact on biomedicine. Nanoparticles, so there's a group at MIT that are working on nanoparticles that have a particular molecule on the surface that allows them to home in and, you know, find a particular kind of cancer cell. And then there's another gizmo that allows the silencing RNA to be released into the cell, and that then finds the cancer gene and kills it. So it's a combination of biological insights with engineering objects, engineering technology. But one of the reasons we're so excited about the convergence is not just about biomedicine, it's about other things as well. So in that other field are batteries that are made by viruses. And these batteries are made at room temperature. The viruses self-assemble into sheets of anodes and cathodes, put together in batteries. The batteries have a charge density equal to state-of-the-art lithium-ion batteries. When these viruses know how to make things without mucking up their world, so the batteries are made without any toxic byproducts. And the group that has figured out how to get viruses to make batteries have recently published a report showing that they can also persuade viruses to make solar cells. And so there's a world of biomanufacturing out there that I believe will change the way all kinds of things that we use are made.
Are there any particular companies that you know of that are really deep into this so far, do you think?
And you know, I know of the names of the founders of the companies, and I don't know the names of the companies. I should.
Okay. But there are companies that I mean, it's beyond the research in the university. And
So I think there's, if I'm right, the one of the nanoparticle companies is called Bind, and it's a nanoparticle for prostate cancer.
Okay. Interesting.
And there are, and I apologize for not being able to pull out of my brain the name of the battery company.
No, that's okay. Thanks. You know, the whole globalness of the world today is much different, of course, than it was 40 years ago when our industrial might was the locomotive. How has that changed at the university level in terms of collaboration, in terms of just how innovation is developing, because we talked a little bit about silos, but I'm sure the reach with it outside of those silos is pretty great.
Yeah, this is a fascinating question, and right now many universities are pursuing many different experiments in globalization, internationalization, you know, global outreach, whatever you want to call it. Some schools have set up campuses around the world so that their students can have an international experience on a campus, can study abroad. You know, some schools just send their students out to other campuses. MIT has taken a somewhat different approach because we're so research intensive, and we believe that research and education are inextricably intertwined. Our international activities generally lead with research, and the students follow. Our view is, you know, I'm personally very excited by the hubs of innovation that are growing up around the world. I think it's great. You know, it's a little scary. Competition's always scary, but it's good for everybody. And it's our view that in the 20th century, pretty much through the 20th century, we could just sit happily in Cambridge or Palo Alto and smart people in the world would come to us, and that would be fine. But that's not going to be true in the 21st century. It already is not true that there are brilliant people around the world who we want to engage in our work, and they're going to want to stay, you know, in Singapore or Shanghai or, you know, Abu Dhabi. And for us to engage with them, we have to actually have partnerships. I had a phenomenally, you know, one of these things, you know, where you just all of a sudden get it. You read about it, you think you understand it, and then you're someplace and you get it. So when I was in India a couple of years ago, I was talking to the head of a company, was doing an experiment with solar, with distributed energy generation. And he said, you know, this is completely non-economic right now, but we have to understand the business of distributed energy generation. So they were busy equipping 12 villages with solar cells. Uh-huh. And I thought, whoa, what a cool experiment. Mm-hmm. And they're not doing that in Somerville. Mm-hmm. You know, so if we're going to be part of the experiment around distributed energy generation in places where they don't have a grid, we've got to do it with partners who are there. Mm-hmm. And so we are setting up research nodes, innovation hubs, in a small number of places around the world. We're being pretty selective about where we make these big bets. Because, you know, we want places where there will be collaborators, worthy collaborators, right, you know, 10, 20, 50 years down the line. And, you know, great relationships take a long time to build. And so we are beginning to set up locations where we think we'll have great relationships.
Right. That's exciting to hear, because I think that's what the Valley, and if you come around the Valley, and those of us who work here see the globalization all the every day. And I think we all look forward to the next 50 years. But unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question. And the one that comes to mind to me, that is kind of a natural one for somebody visiting Silicon Valley, is to ask, what was your first technology purchase and what was your most recent?
Yeah, great. So I'm going to embarrass you know, myself in that, you know, when I was growing up, you know, the cool technology. Right. Was a transistor radio. You know, a radio, I mean, it was just shocking. A radio could be, you know, small. So that was, you know, right. So in my own mind,
with
that was...
a little battery?
A little battery kind of crammed in. I got my first Macintosh in 1984. So that was, you know... fell in love. And so I'm, you know, all Mac all the time.
Okay.
I have an iPhone and an iPad, on which I'm carrying too many books on this trip I'm about to go on.
Right.
And, you know, I use technology, and I love it, and it's just, it's hard to imagine where we are today.
When you think back to the transistor radio.
Transistor radio. I say, you know, I also love my Bose products, but...
Yeah. Don't we all, especially on planes. I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Susan Hockfield, president of MIT, the MIT Club of Northern California, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.